Good morning. I also thank the American health professionals and public health professionals for inviting me. I always welcome the opportunity to be able to clarify the differences between National Guard and also emphasize the same aspects that we face with the active component, Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marines. And Suzanne and I see each other regularly at meetings, and I'm always acting as the squeaky wheel because the National Guard is different and unique, but we have similar goals, we have similar missions, and we work often with the National Program for Sexual Assault Prevention and Response. So I do serve as the chief. I used to be the program manager, but I said recently my responsibilities have changed, so I'm doing an awful lot of briefings lately. So this falls right into that. I have to thank David Lloyd, who was the director of the DOD Family Advocacy Program, for this slide. David and I partnered to be able to do a briefing for the Battered Women's Justice Project for a webinar, and David came up with this amazing slide to be really clearly stating how we're the same and the different from the active component. We always call Army, Air Force, Navy, and then Marines under the Navy the active component. They're the folks who are always on orders. They're always on duty. They are called Title 10 because it falls under the U.S. Code. When we refer to the reserve component, both National Guard and the reserves fall into the reserve component. But what's different for the National Guard is we have two National Guards. We have the Army National Guard and we have the Air National Guard, and they fall under Army and Air Force. However, when they're working in the state for the state governor, they're falling under the authority and the guidance and direction of each state governor. However, the president can call the National Guard up for federal service or Title 10 orders, and many of you are probably very familiar with the National Guard serving in the war efforts that have been going on since 2003. They have served a vital role and a very difficult role in many cases because of the way they function within the state. They also are working toward doing state missions regularly. But when we talk about the reserves, Air Force, Army, the Coast Guard, Navy, and Marine Corps reserves, they're always, whenever they're serving on duty, they're always under the guidance from the President, always on federal orders. So the National Guard, both state orders and control, and also federal whenever they're called up. This is a really busy slide, so we're going to try to follow some of the ideas that show the challenges for both the reserve and the active component. If we look at the top on the left-hand side, we've got the active component. They're always full-time military life, always. They go deploy, they come back, and sometimes the active component, when they retire or switch, they can be a reservist then. They may join the National Guard. They may join the Army or Air Force reserves as they go along. They're called up by the President. The President can also call up the reserve component, and it goes back and forth between being on state or federal orders constantly, and it's all related to their combat deployment back and forth. When we look at the National Guard and the reserve component for the Army National Guard and the Air National Guard at the bottom, they can be called up by the governor on what is called state duty missions. And they're what is on Title 32 at that point in time. In other words, they're under the Title 32 code and laws and guidance and payment and benefits. All of that follow under that U.S. code. Sometimes they're called up for natural or human disasters, relief. Many of you saw, if you remember, the TV show from CNN and everybody with rescuing at Hurricane Katrina, the National Guard finally came in and was able to be there helping many days after. I'm told by many folks who worked that mission that they were right on the outside waiting. They were ready, they were waiting, but they did not receive the orders to be able to move in. So according to our folks, they were ready, they could have gone in earlier. But we did have sexual assaults occur on that mission. Because anytime we have these missions, we sometimes have sexual assaults. And they can be called up for Kansas. I remember a year or so ago, they called up them to help throw hay out of airplanes during blizzards so the cattle in the farmlands were able to have food to be able to make it through the blizzard. The National Guard does this on a regular basis, meet both federal requirements and the state requirements. The reserve component is oftentimes on part-time military life, both for the reserves who are Title 10 and also for the National Guard. So they may have civilian jobs, and that's where you come in to be able to help offer those resources to our Guard members and our reserve members when they're not on federal duty and they don't have the benefits from the active component. If the National Guard deploys and is on active duty orders, Title 10 orders, then when they come back off orders, they can also receive care at the Veterans Administration. So that's why we have the VA in there. And they can get military sexual trauma treatment if they were sexually assaulted when they were on orders. And they have to have that evidence that they deployed, that they had the form that indicates that they were on deployment. So we also have benefits from the state, but it comes from state resources rather than the federal resources. So those are some of the situations that our Guard members face. How we talk about the differences often are the installation versus non-installation based services. When we talk about an active duty installation, such as Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, or Fort Hood in Texas, those are installations that are self-contained. They have medical treatment facilities, they have their own law enforcement, their security forces, their investigative resources, their family advocacy programs for the active component. When we talk about the reserve component, specifically the National Guard, they are community-based. We don't have them located living on an actual installation. They get their resources from the community. And that's why we like to partner so much with the civilian realm, because even though they may be a National Guard member, they're depending on the community many times for their health care, for their mental health care, for those additional resources from hospitals and so forth. We have, and I have to change this number because the Air Guard is now telling me they have 90 wings. How many of you know somebody who's served in the National Guard? Any hands here? Okay. How many of you notice sometimes on back roads you're driving along and you see these things that look like great big garages with Humvees sitting outside? Have you ever seen those? Those are our Army Guard armories that they are based in companies and units, small sizes. The National Guard for the Air Guard oftentimes is located near an airport. You may drive by an airport and see a sign outside that says 176 Fighter Wing. And that is their location for meeting for drills, but they don't live there, and their health care and their family advocacy and counseling care does not come from that resource. It comes from the civilian community. We have National Guard members in every single county in the entire United States, including Alaska, which is amazing because it's huge, huge state. So when Are active duty, they're always considered military status 24/7. They can be called up at any time. They're expected to work 24 hours a day if the mission calls for it. The reservists and the National Guard are either in a civilian status or a federal military status. When they're federal military, they have special orders that say you're working for the president right now. The civilian status, they may be working as a teacher. They may be working as a lawyer downtown. They may be a garage mechanic. But that's their civilian job. And then they go on one weekend a month to our drills that they attend. And when we have them at drill, that's when they're on full-time National Guard duty, and all the guidance, requirement for training, sexual assault prevention, all of that exists. That's a good time when they get their prevention training. The challenge we have, as Suzanne mentioned, are the restricted reporting versus the unrestricted reporting, because the restricted reporting benefits, entitlements, come from the federal government, that their health care is taken care of, their counseling is taken care of. So if the assault happened when they were in a civilian status and not on duty, then they're coming to the civilian community to get that care. So that's one difference, where the resources, what status they're in when they were sexually assaulted, has an awful lot of impact on where they get their entitlements for benefits for care. Whether it's from the state, federal, or civilian community. At the National Guard, we're also focusing on the spectrum of prevention for really addressing the issues. I'll just go over some of the areas that we've addressed so far. We partner and we work closely with DOD SAPRO in order to ensure that policy revisions, that type of thing, also address the uniqueness of the Guard. And the revised DODD that's coming out will really have a special part in there that makes it more applicable to Guard. We also have legislative input to ensure that Guard members are receiving attention with Congress in order to ensure their benefits are there. What we have for organizational practices at each state level and wing level, we have sexual assault response coordinators, our SARCs, and the victim advocates that are in charge of state programs. Before we said 50 states, but it's really we have 54, because we also have Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, Guam, and the District of Columbia that have National Guard forces in place that also are part of our 54 we talk about. We work closely in the states with the state coalitions to follow, to partner with networking, support, and also response capability when the sexual assaults have occurred in non-duty status. And we are out there, as this opportunity allows me to be able to help people in the community understand the differences, how we can educate the caretakers and the challenges about the challenges and the support we need from the civilian community for our National Guard members. We are promoting community education, and one of the things that we're doing in about 2 weeks is having a National Guard Leadership Summit on Sexual Assault Prevention and Response. It's our second one. We have very high-level leadership from all states in to be able to be educated and really promote that community education from the unit level on up. And strengthening individual knowledge and skills, both the Air Force and the Army both have bystander intervention programs in place for prevention of sexual assault. They're moving toward that at the unit level. It's a challenge to be able to do that because we have the drill weekend time when they have a lot of other training that they have to accomplish. But we are moving forward, and I just had the chance to brief our Chief of the National Guard Bureau this morning prior to getting here to let him know where we are in our prevention education. So thank you. I think that's it then.